Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Serving the poor and sick, we look back at the figure of the late Grand Master of the Order of the Knights of Malta, Fra Andrew Bertie, whose funeral takes place today. Drink-centred, we shine the spotlight on what Ireland's Catholic Church is doing to alert schoolchildren against the dangers of binge drinking and find out what two teenage girls think about their nation's boozing culture. Small but deadly, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva talks about the lingering impact of cluster bombs ahead of next week's international conference that aims to draw up a treaty to ban these types of weapons. And shameful slavery. We take a look at a UN forum on human trafficking and the important role of faith-based groups in the effort to combat this phenomenon. Rome, the funeral took place today for the late Grand Master of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, Fra Andrew Bertie, who died on February the 7th. The Requiem Mass at the Basilica of Santa Sabina was presided over by the Order of Malta's patron, Cardinal Pio Largi, and concelebrated by several other prominent members of the Roman Curia, including the Cardinals Paul Poupart, Jean-Louis Touron, Renato Martino and John Patrick Foley. Andrew Bertie was born in 1929 and was the first Briton to be elected Grand Master during the Order's 900-year history. My colleague Emma McCarthy looks back at the figure of the 78th Grand Master.
Tuitio Fidei et obsequium pauperum, defence of the faith and assistance to the poor and suffering.
The fact that our aim is to help the poor and the sick, that was our primary aim and always has been.
That is the voice of Andrew Willoughby Ninian Bertie, Prince and Grand Master of the Sovereign Military Hospital or Order of St. John of Jerusalem, of Rhodes and of Malta. Fra Bertie, as he preferred to be called, was the 78th Grand Master of the Order of Malta, one of the oldest chivalry orders of the Catholic Church, which dates back to the 11th century when a group of knights founded a hospital in the holy city of Jerusalem, just before the First Crusades.
The other military orders were there to fight the Saracens and to save Spain or the Holy Land or Prussia from the pagans and things like that. But we always had this special commitment to the poor and the sick. And that's why we've continued. Our aims today are exactly the same as they were when in 1099. The sanctification of our members through service to the sick.
Born in 1929 in London to an aristocratic family, Fra Bertie was educated at the Benedictine School of Ampleforth College in Yorkshire. He went on to study modern history at Christ Church, Oxford, and had a particular love for Africa and the Orient. Admitted to the Sovereign Military Order of Malta in 1956, he took the vows of poverty, chastity and obedience in 1981, becoming a full religious member. In April 1988, he was elected Grand Master and subsequently became the Hospitaller of the Sanctuary of Lourdes.
He was a very calm and pious man with very sound judgment.
Albrecht Boeslager is Grand Hospitaller of the Order.
And we really have lost a leader who we knew in our back to and who supported all the works of the Order worldwide. He travelled a lot. He knew the order well, very well. I can say he was loved by all the members and volunteers of the order.
Fra Bertie, a consummate linguist, oversaw many changes in the order, modernizing its centuries-old approach to humanitarian programs, increasing its membership and diplomatic missions with an emphasis on afflicted countries in times of natural disasters or civil conflicts. Though a British native, his home had become a simple farm in Malta, where he would retire for rest to tend his orange groves and teach judo courses to local children. The Grand Commander of the Order, Fra Giacomo delle Torri del Tempio di Sanguinetto, has been sworn in as Lieutenant ad interim until a new Grand Master is elected. I'm Emo McCarthy.
Ireland has long had a reputation for its pub culture and its enjoyment of alcohol. But all too often, this love of drinking can end not just in drunkenness, but alcohol addiction. And that's where the problem begins. Surveys show that young people in Ireland do more binge drinking than any other country in Europe. And this practice is having a knock-on effect on people's health, sexual behaviour, and relations within families. In response to these worrying statistics, the Catholic Church in Ireland has been at the forefront of initiatives urging the use of moderation when it comes to alcohol consumption. In a DVD released to coincide with this year's Lenten season, the bishops urge young people to respect themselves and stay free from the slavery of addiction to alcohol or drugs. The DVD, titled Find the Balance, Dare to Dream, has been distributed to hundreds of secondary schools throughout the nation. A group of teenagers recently held a discussion with Bishop Eamon Walsh, the Auxiliary Bishop of Dublin, about alcohol issues. They also discussed the new DVD and the impact it has had on them and their friends. John Taff is the coordinator of the Irish Bishops' Initiative Against Drugs and Alcohol. He explains the thinking behind this latest DVD project and how the church is calling for moderation during this Lenten season.
Well, I had a drink with a friend of mine a week ago today. He was celebrating a month and a half too late, St. Paddy's Day. Well, I bought him around and he bought me around and a bouncer bought us another. What's an Irish boy from a good family?
The bishop's pastoral letter last year asked for people to take up a challenge of refraining from alcohol and asking young people to drink moderately and take up that challenge. This year and this Lent week, we have brought out a DVD titled Find the Balance, Dare to Dream, and it went out to all schools, secondary schools in the whole of the country here in Ireland, and it was to raise discussion around refraining from alcohol, especially over the Lenten period, to refrain or to make decisions and personal choices to drink moderately. Because we have such difficulty around binge drinking, so I suppose the church's response is we're trying to work with young people, with parents, but also with the schools on a national level to see can we play a part in getting young people to make that personal choice to drink moderately or refrain from drinking until they're of the age to drink.
How badly is excessive alcohol consumption damaging Irish society? You know, what is the negative fallout from this problem?
I suppose the negative impact here in Ireland is really getting worse on the cost to health. Billions is being spent on health here, point of view, but also then there is the justice, like the local police here would talk about the majority of issues that they're addressing. Call-outs from local police would be to do with alcohol-related issues of violence, of drink driving, lots of issues like that.
Bishop Eamon Walsh, who's the Auxiliary Bishop of Dublin and the Vice Chair of the Church's Drugs and Alcohol Initiative, he met recently with young people, he had a discussion with them, didn't he, on alcohol issues. What were the main views of the young people that emerged during this discussion?
So many of the young people have said, I mean, advertisement was an issue that they feel they're bombarded with advertisement around alcohol here. They talk about peer influences, talk about, you know, the amount of availability of money because the country is kind of has so much money over the last years with the Celtic Tiger that they have so much kind of spare money there to drink. An awful lot of different kind of facts came up through the evaluation, which they gave fed back to the bishop. And we're again feeding it into the national government that are kind of having kind of lobbying meetings and that around dealing with the issues of underage drinking and binge drinking among young people. I suppose the big things he talked about was peer pressures, advertisements, lack of facilities, boredom for young people. There was lots of issues came in, but I suppose one thing that came up as well was that their own moral views, they're lacking something in their lives, and I suppose the church here feels that what part can we play in that?
Sure enough, I drowned and I wound up at the pearly gates, where St. Peter said, you're drunk as hell and son, you should have ate. So he sent me back down to get a bite, but instead I bought another.
Well, we've heard the view of the adults and experts, but what about the young people themselves?
why do so many Irish teenagers indulge in binge drinking? And how do they feel about this whole issue? Niamh Coyne is a 17-year-old Catholic schoolgirl from near Dublin who took part in that meeting with Bishop Walsh and saw the DVD. She gives her feedback.
I thought it was really, really interesting because instead of it like preaching out to us, it actually showed us from a person's perspective how to keep in moderation and stuff like that, like their day-to-day lives and how an over-excess of alcohol could affect them. And it does make you think, because you kind of have to realise yourself that you can't just go out and drink as much as you like. There are consequences to it. It even affects everything that you do, you know, like it is very thought-provoking. It does make you realise that alcohol is better in moderation.
Another teenager who also saw the Bishop's DVD was 16-year-old Catherine Gardner from the same Catholic school. She too was enthusiastic about this initiative by the Catholic Church.
I think it was a brilliant initiative. It really got people talking and a good debate going, and I think that was the whole idea of it. Like, people were kind of speaking about the dangers, you know, you had different people from society representing different groups in society, and then you really saw the dangers and how you had to appreciate moderation and maybe abstaining if that's what your job or your social class meant.
Do you think, though, that in general it would be fair to say that many people, particularly the young, do think that drinking is kind of cool and glamorous?
Yeah, absolutely. It was sworn as a badge of honour in Ireland. You know, I can drink 21 pints and I can still stumble into school and my mum and dad won't catch me. The thing is, you need to kind of separate that from life and, you know, make that decision yourself that it isn't really that cool and recognise the dangers out there.
And do you know many people, perhaps within your school or within your area that you live, that do drink too much, who are, you know, perhaps regularly binge drink?
Absolutely. There's, I'd say 90% of Irish teenagers have had a drink by the time they're 15, and like more than that would even drink on a regular basis. My personal friends would even drink and be regular drinkers, but the thing is, they support me in my decision not to drink.
Like Niamh, Catherine is also a non-drinker. Probably not an easy decision in a nation like Ireland where heavy drinking is so common. She explains the reasons behind her choice.
It was a personal decision that I made because at the moment I'm 16 years old and I've my whole life ahead of me. I don't need drink to enjoy myself, and I think that's something that Irish people need to learn.
A lot of young people, though, talk about peer pressure when it comes to things like drinking or taking drugs. I mean, do you find sometimes that people are trying to persuade you to drink?
I think there is peer pressure, definitely, and I don't think it's anything we escape. But the thing is, you have to have enough kind of gumption yourself to turn around and say, well, no, it's something I don't want to do. And I think if your friends are your real friends, they'll support you in that and whatever decisions you make.
So let's try and find out a bit more from Niamh and Catherine about why they think so many of their young friends indulge in binge drinking. For her part, Catherine believes one of the main reasons is that Ireland's culture and social life is so drink-centred.
I think there's like a number of reasons. I suppose, firstly, because of the culture. You know, Irish people are renowned for drinking. It's known to be part of our culture. And it's always there. From the day you're born, you're surrounded by drink. At every family event, at every friend's party, at all these kind of occasions, it's all drink-centred. It's not about the occasion itself. Then also you have the whole advertising thing. And it's like every sports event, every school competition, everything in Ireland is sponsored by alcoholic companies. And, you know, you can't get away from that in Irish society. And I think that's where the problem lies.
In a country that has such a strongly rooted tradition of drinking alcohol, Niamh says peer pressure and advertising definitely play an important role in encouraging young people to hit the bottle.
I do think that although it's not as strong as it was, the peer pressure is still there. So many people do drink. So many teenagers are actually affected by drink that you know, it's unusual to find many people that would really call themselves like social drinkers or anything like that. So I do think that, you know, I'm lucky enough with the fact that my friends won't pressure me into anything that I don't want to do.
Do you know people you consider do have a drinking problem, but they're always binge drinking, they're actually drinking so much that they're being sick, they're throwing up afterwards?
Yes, I would. I wouldn't be extremely close friends with them, but I would know of them, and the ages would vary, which is what makes it so scary. You know, it could be girls of 12, 13 year old that you'd hear talking about how drunk they got at the weekends. And then I'll also remember, when we get our exam results over here, for junior cert, it's a very big deal, and a lot of people that I knew, they'd come in the next day and I'd be like, oh, how was your night, like how did you celebrate, and they'd say, I don't remember. And you know, it really is very, very scary when you hear things like that.
But it's not just peer pressure pressure on advertising that help encourage the young to binge drink. Neve believes their parents, and adults in general, should set a good example to the young by practicing the virtue of moderation when it comes to alcohol.
I do think that a lot of the parents should be more aware of the fact that they drink and then they tell their kids that they can't drink, and it's not a good example. You know, you're contradicting yourself, because why aren't you allowed to do something when your parents can do it? So I do think that parents need to be more aware of the fact that you can't tell your child, don't do this, because they're going to want to do it more.
The Irish Church says what we tend to forget is that alcohol is a depressant drug capable of bringing about an addiction. Heavy drinking and being drunk often is seen as just harmless fun nowadays, especially among the young. But experts say the sobering reality is that alcohol addiction can tear a family apart and destroy a life.
Well, I bought him around and he bought me around, and a bouncer bought us another. What's an Irish boy from a good family doing in the gutter?
In that report, you heard the voices of two pupils from a Catholic school near Dublin, 17-year-old Neve Coyne and 16-year-old Catherine Gardner. And you also heard at the beginning the voice of John Taff, the coordinator of the Irish Bishops' Initiative Against Drugs and Alcohol. Small, cheap and deadly is a description that was first coined to describe the lingering and often devastating impact of landmines on civilians. But many critics see cluster bombs in the same light. Cluster munitions contain a device that, when opened, releases a large number of bomblets that are supposed to explode upon impact. However, they often have a high failure rate. This means that, like landmines, cluster bombs carry on killing and maiming people long after a conflict has ended. The deadly impact of cluster bombs on innocent civilians was highlighted during and after the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah forces, when more than 1 million cluster bombs were dropped on South Lebanon. The lingering effects of this massive use of cluster bombs by Israeli forces in South Lebanon helped add impetus to a growing international campaign to ban these types of munitions. Next week sees the opening of an international conference in Wellington, New Zealand, that is aimed at drawing up a comprehensive treaty to ban cluster bombs. Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, and he spoke to me about the scourge of cluster bombs and why this conference is so significant.
It's the last step, in a way, in preparing the international community to address the issue of cluster munitions and the need to respond to the victims of these types of mines, munitions. And so the gathering that is going to take place in Wellington will see the participation of over 100 countries, some 500 participants. It's a large gathering that signifies concern and the priority that the world community wants to give to this issue. So the importance is both the fact that it will finalize the position and the alliances of these countries in pushing forward a new instrument for the banning of the use of cluster munitions. And second, the will to give a sense of progress to the issue of disarmament that in the last few years has not been moving very far or very fast.
When it comes to cluster munitions, does the Holy See believe that a ban on such weapons is needed and that, in fact, the use of cluster munitions is not morally permissible?
The position of the Holy See and some other countries is that to achieve the goal that we want to achieve, namely protecting civilians from harm in the case of conflict, these kind of weapons should not be used because they create an indiscriminate damage to both military and civilian targets. So the issue is how to protect people, and especially after a conflict when these munitions remain underground unexploded, protect children and women that are going to work in the fields or that are gathering woods or that are simply playing underground. And this objective of protecting victims is the motor, in a way, to push for a new instrument that bans these type of weapons. The ban itself, hopefully, will be clearly worded and specific, and it will facilitate the process of peacemaking, and it will give encouragement to all those who are working in the Conference of Disarmament to facilitate eliminating as much as possible the race for new arms, and to give a sign that it's possible to work together in banning even other forms of weapons.
Have you met survivors of cluster bomb explosions? And if so, what impact did this have on you, you know, seeing them and their injuries, their mutilations?
I did, actually. I had a chance a few years ago to be in some refugee camps and to see people that have just arrived crossing minefields, holding their leg amputated by the explosion of mines and by remnants of cluster munitions, both in Africa, in the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, for example, or in Asia many years ago at the end of the Vietnam conflict with the enormous amount of mines of all types, including cluster munitions, that have remained underground in Cambodia and in Laos.
What, though, are the main countries holding out against banning cluster bombs? I mean, there's a number of Western countries in this group, isn't there?
Yes, for the time being, there are reservations, and some of the big countries like China or the Russian Federation or other countries like Germany or the United States that have the willingness to do something in this area to limit the damage to victims, but they have a very nuanced position that would move in the direction of having better technology, more precise technology that would ensure that the target of these weapons is strictly military. It's a process that is not so clear, in fact, and that's why there is still some negotiation in place.
Do you agree that, you know, if these weapons were to be made more efficient, that there could be a moral justification for them, or do you think they should be banned?
Well, my position and the position of many other countries besides the position of the Holy See is that we aim to reduce any kind of armaments, and therefore the priority should be given to eliminate the use of arms of any type, and in this case, the use of arms that, no matter how technically developed and precise, always become cause of damage and create victims. So we need to go beyond the discussion of technical ability to perfect these weapons and to really go for a ban. And in that way, we ensure that we will have more security in the long run and that we will protect people in a much more effective way.
The war between Israel and Lebanon, which saw, of course, a massive use of cluster bombs on the part of Israel, did highlight, shall we say, the lingering damage that these munitions can cause. Do you believe that the international community is moving slowly but inexorably towards a comprehensive ban, that it's only a matter of time now?
Two things. The case of the war in Lebanon has been a reminder of the great damage that these weapons are causing on civilian population and on children and women. And therefore, that the responsibility of the international community to the victims of these weapons has to be articulated in a clear and specific way. And that situation has given an impulse, has prompted many individuals, NGOs, states to move in the direction of a new legally binding instrument that will ban these munitions. And second, the conference in Wellington is preparing the final draft of an instrument that will be negotiated in Dublin in May with a view of arriving at an agreed binding instrument that will achieve exactly this goal of eliminating the use of these cluster munitions so that the world will no longer see people maimed by these weapons or children destroyed, even killed sometimes by these remaining bomblets or mines in the ground long after the conflict has concluded.
I was speaking there to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. A top Vatican official was among delegates attending a UN-sponsored forum on human trafficking that took place in Vienna earlier this week. In his address to conference participants, Archbishop Agostino Marchetto, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, said that human trafficking is the most shameful phenomenon of our era, and stressed that women and children are its most vulnerable victims. We spoke with Troll Vester, spokesman for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime in Vienna. He spelt out the extent of the trafficking problem and said the role of faith-based groups is essential in any effort to combat this practice.
Well, we calculate with the fact that at any given time, 2.5 million people are in forced labour as a result of trafficking. And in terms of the financial situation, we do estimate that the organized crime groups have an annual income of approximately $31 billion a year. With the Vienna Forum, we have different aims, specifically three aims. One is to bring excellent new initiatives from a local level to a global level. A lot of times these initiatives on the ground, they get lost and nobody knows about it. And we try to bring them to everybody's attention at a very high government level. The second thing we aim at is to building new partnerships and doing this in terms of thinking a little bit outside the box. So we, for instance, have created what we call an interfaith dialogue where different faith-based organizations are discussing how to move forward in fighting human trafficking, which is extremely interesting and something that will move ahead, in my opinion, in this year. The last thing we're aiming at is having a real impact on the ground. And by this, I mean that we get more convictions of the traffickers. So far, it seems like they have a lot of impunity around the world. And at the same token, we also would like to see a lot better protection of the victims of human trafficking.
This issue about faith-based groups and this interfaith dialogue, incorporating those groups, and what is it about those groups that will allow, or what are your hopes for greater effectiveness in this regard?
Well, when we're talking about the interfaith dialogue, it really goes back to a pre-conference for the Vienna Forum that we had in Cape Town in October, where they agreed on an interfaith declaration stipulating different ways to move ahead in the future, especially recognizing the role that faith-based organizations in all religions can in doing awareness raising within the local community. They really have easier access to many people that, for instance, we don't have in the UN, and also the trust that people are giving to their local faith-based organizations could really help increasing the protection of the victims.
That was Troll Vester of the UN Office on Drug and Crime, speaking to my colleague Irene Lagan. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.